3. Dependence. It is not death that the very old tell me they fear. It is what happens short of death, losing their hearing, their memory, their best friends, their way of life. As Felix put it to me, old age is a continuous series of losses. Philip Roth put it more bitterly in his novel Everyman. Old age is not a battle. Old age is a massacre. With luck and fastidiousness, eating well, exercising, keeping our blood pressure under control, getting medical help when we need it, people can often live and manage a very long time. But eventually the losses accumulate to the point where life's daily requirements become more than we can physically or mentally manage on our own. As fewer of us are struck dead out of the blue, most of us will spend significant periods of our lives too reduced and debilitated to live independently. We do not like to think about this eventuality. As a result, most of us are unprepared for it. We rarely pay more than glancing attention to how we live when we need help until it's too late to do much about it. When Felix came to this crossroads, the orthopedic shoe to drop wasn't his. It was Bella's. Year by year, I witnessed the progression in her difficulties. Felix remained in astonishingly good health right into his 90s. He had no medical crises and maintained his weekly exercise regimen. He continued to teach chaplaincy students about geriatrics and to serve on Orchard Cove's health committee. He didn't even have to stop driving. But Bella was fading. She lost her vision completely. Her hearing became poor. Her memory became markedly impaired. When we had dinner, she had to be reminded more than once that I was sitting across from her. She and Felix felt the sorrows of their losses, but also the pleasures of what they still had. Although she might not have been able to remember me or others she didn't know too well, she enjoyed company and conversation and sought both out. Moreover, she and Felix still had their own private, decades-long conversation that had never stopped. He found great purpose in caring for her, and she, likewise, found great meaning in being there for him. The physical presence of each other gave them comfort. He dressed her, bathed her, helped feed her. When they walked, they held hands. At night, they lay in bed in each other's arms, awake and nestling for a while, before finally drifting off to sleep. Those moments, Felix said, remained among their most cherished. He felt they knew each other and loved each other more than at any time in their nearly 70 years together. One day, however, they had an experience that revealed just how fragile their life had become. Bella developed a cold, causing fluid to accumulate in her ears. An eardrum ruptured, and with that, she became totally deaf. That was all it took to sever the thread between them. With her blindness and memory problems, the hearing loss made it impossible for Felix to achieve any kind of communication with her. He tried drawing out letters on the palm of her hand, but she couldn't make them out. Even the simplest matters, getting her dressed, for instance, became a nightmare of confusion for her. Without sensory grounding, she lost track of time of day. She grew severely confused, at times delusional and agitated. He couldn't take care of her. He became exhausted from stress and lack of sleep. He didn't know what to do, but there was a system for such situations. The people at the residence proposed transferring her to a skilled nursing unit, a nursing home floor. He couldn't bear the thought of it. No, he said. She needed to stay at home with him. Before the issue was forced, they got a reprieve. 2.5 weeks into the ordeal, Bella's right eardrum mended, and although the hearing in her left ear was lost permanently, the hearing in her right ear came back. Our communication is more difficult, Felix said, but at least it is possible. I asked what he would do if the hearing in her right ear went again, or if there were some other such catastrophe, and he told me he didn't know. I'm in dread of what would happen if she becomes too hard for me to care for, he said. I try not to think too far ahead. I don't think about next year. It's too depressing. I just think about next week. It's the route people take the world over, and that is understandable. But it tends to backfire. Eventually, the crisis they dreaded arrived. They were walking together when suddenly Bella fell. He wasn't sure what had happened. They'd been walking slowly. The ground was flat. He'd had her by the arm. But she went down in a heap and snapped the fibula in both her legs, the long, thin outer bone that runs from knee to ankle. The emergency room doctors had to cast each of her limbs to above the knee. What Felix feared most had happened. Her needs became massively more than he could handle. Bella was forced to move to the nursing home floor, where she could have round-the-clock aides and nurses looking after her. You might think that this would have been a relief for both Bella and Felix, lifting all kinds of burdens of physical care from them. But the experience was more complicated than that. On the one hand, the staff members were nothing but professional. They took over most of the tasks Felix had long managed so laboriously, the bathing, toileting, dressing, and all the other routine needs of a person who has become severely disabled. They freed him to spend his time as he wished, whether with Bella or on his own. But for all the staff members' efforts, Felix and Bella could find their presence exasperating. Some tended to Bella more as a patient than as a person. She had a certain way she liked her hair brushed, for instance, but no one asked or figured it out. Felix had worked out the best method to cut up her food so she could swallow it without difficulty, how to position her so she was most comfortable, how to dress her the way she preferred. But no matter how much he tried to show the staff, many of them did not see the point. Sometimes, in exasperation, he'd give up and simply redo whatever they had done, causing conflict and resentment. "We were getting in each other's way," Felix said. He worried, too, that the unfamiliar surroundings were making Bella confused. After a few days, he decided to move her back home. He'd just have to figure out how to deal with her. Their apartment was only a floor away, but somehow that made all the difference. Exactly why can be hard to pinpoint. Felix still ended up hiring an around-the-clock staff of nurses and aides, and the remaining 6 weeks until the casts could come off were physically exhausting for him, yet he was relieved. He and Bella felt more control over her life. She was in her own place, in her own bed, with him beside her. And that mattered tremendously to him, because 4 days after the casts came off, 4 days after she'd begun walking again, she died. They'd sat down to lunch. She turned to him and said, "I don't feel well." Then she collapsed. An ambulance whisked her to the local hospital. He didn't want to slow the medics down. So he let them go and he followed after in his car. She died in the short time between her arrival and his. When I saw him 3 months later, he was still despondent. "I feel as if a part of my body is missing. I feel as if I have been dismembered," he told me. His voice cracked and his eyes were rimmed red. He had one great solace, however, that she hadn't suffered, that she'd got to spend her last few weeks in peace at home, in the warmth of their long love, instead of up on a nursing floor, a lost and disoriented patient. Alice Hobson had something very much like the same dread of leaving her home. It was the one place where she felt she belonged and remained in charge of her life. But after the incident with the men who had victimized her, it was apparent that she wasn't safe living on her own anymore. My father-in-law organized a few visits to senior living residences for her. "She didn't care for this process," Jim said, "but she reconciled herself to it." He was determined to find a place she would like and thrive in. But it was not to be. As I watched the aftermath, I gradually began to understand the reasons why, and they were reasons that bring into question our entire system of care for the dependent and debilitated. Jim looked for a place that was within a reasonable driving distance for the family and within a price range she could afford with the proceeds of selling her house. He also wanted a community that offered a continuum of care, much like Orchard Cove, where I visited Felix and Bella, with apartments for independent living and a floor with the around-the-clock nursing capabilities that she might someday need. He came up with a variety of places for them to visit, nearer ones and farther ones, for-profit and not-for-profit. The place Alice ultimately chose was a high-rise senior living complex that I will call Longwood House, a non-profit facility affiliated with the Episcopal Church. Some of her friends from church lived there. The drive to and from Jim's home was barely 10 minutes. The community was active and thriving. To Alice and the family, it had by far the greatest appeal. Most of the others were too commercial, Jim said. Her one-bedroom independent living apartment was more spacious than I'd expected. It had a full kitchen, enough room for her dining set, and plenty of light. My mother-in-law, Nan, made sure it got a fresh coat of paint and arranged for a decorator Alice had used before to help place furniture and hang pictures. It means something when you can move in and see all your things in their own places, your own silver in your kitchen drawer, Nan said. But when I saw Alice a few weeks after her move, she didn't seem at all happy or adjusted. Never one to complain, she didn't say anything angry or sad or bitter, but she was withdrawn in a way I hadn't seen before. She remained recognizably herself, but the light had gone out from behind her eyes. At first, I thought that this had to do with the loss of her car and the freedom that came with it. When she moved into Longwood House, she'd brought her Chevy Impala and fully intended to keep driving, but on her very first day there, when she went to take the car out for some errands, it was gone. She called the police and reported it stolen. An officer arrived, took a description, looked for clues, and promised an investigation. A while later, Jim arrived and, on a hunch, looked in the giant food store parking lot next door. There it was. She had got confused and parked in the wrong lot without realizing it. Mortified, she gave up driving for good. In one day, she lost her car as well as her home. But there seemed to be more to her sense of loss and unhappiness. She had a kitchen, but stopped cooking. She took her meals in the Longwood House dining room with everyone else, but ate little, lost weight, and didn't seem to like having the company. She avoided organized group activities, even the ones she might have enjoyed. A sewing circle like the one she'd had at her church, a book group, gym and fitness classes, trips to the Kennedy Center. The community offered opportunities to organize activities of your own if you didn't like what was on offer, but she stuck to herself. We thought she was depressed. Jim and Nan took her to see a doctor who put her on medication. It didn't help. Somewhere along the 7-mile drive between the house she'd given up on Greencastle Street and Longwood House, her life fundamentally changed in ways she did not want, but could do nothing about. The idea of being unhappy in a place as comfortable as Longwood House would have seemed laughable at one time. In 1913, Mabel Nassau, a Columbia University graduate student, conducted a neighborhood study of the living conditions of 100 elderly people in Greenwich Village, 65 women and 35 men. In this era before pensions and Social Security, all were poor. Only 27 were able to support themselves, living off savings, taking in lodgers, or doing odd jobs like selling newspapers, cleaning homes, mending umbrellas. Most were too ill or debilitated to work. One woman, for instance, whom Nassau called Mrs. C., was a 62-year-old widow who'd made just enough as a domestic servant to afford a small back room with an oil stove in a rooming house. Illness had recently ended her work, however, and she now had severe leg swelling with varicose veins that left her bedbound. Miss S. was unusually sick and had a 72-year-old brother with diabetes who, in this era before insulin treatment, was fast becoming crippled and emaciated as the disease killed him. Mr. M. was a 67-year-old Irish former longshoreman who'd been left disabled by a paralytic stroke. A large number had become simply feeble, by which Nassau seemed to mean that they were too senile to manage for themselves. Unless family could take such people in, they had virtually no options left except a poorhouse or almshouse, as it was often called. These institutions went back centuries in Europe and the United States. If you were elderly and in need of help but did not have a child or independent wealth to fall back on, a poorhouse was your only source of shelter. Poorhouses were grim, odious places to be incarcerated, and that was the telling term used at the time. They housed poor of all types. Elderly paupers, out-of-luck immigrants, young drunks, the mentally ill, and their function was to put the inmates to work for their presumed intemperance and moral turpitude. Supervisors usually treated elderly paupers leniently in work assignments, but they were inmates like the rest. Husbands and wives were separated. Basic physical care was lacking. Filth and dilapidation were the norm. A 1912 report from the Illinois State Charities Commission described one county's poorhouse as unfit to decently house animals. The men and women lived without any attempt at classification by age or needs in bare 10 by 12 foot rooms infested with bedbugs. Rats and mice overrun the place. Flies swarm the food. There are no bathtubs. A 1909 Virginia report described elderly people dying untended, receiving inadequate nutrition and care, and contracting tuberculosis from uncontrolled contagion. Funds were chronically inadequate for disabled care. In one case, the report noted, a warden, faced with a woman who tended to wander off and no staff to mind her, made her carry a 28-pound ball and chain. Nothing provoked greater terror for the aged than the prospect of such institutions. Nonetheless, by the 1920s and 1930s, when Alice and Richmond Hobson were young, two-thirds of poorhouse residents were elderly. Gilded Age prosperity had sparked embarrassment about these conditions. Then the Great Depression sparked a nationwide protest movement. Elderly middle-class people who'd worked and saved all their lives found their savings wiped out. In 1935, with the passage of Social Security, the United States joined Europe in creating a system of national pensions. Suddenly, a widow's future was secure, and retirement, once the exclusive provenance of the rich, became a mass phenomenon. In time, poorhouses passed from memory in the industrialized world, but they persist elsewhere. In developing countries, they have become common, because economic growth is breaking up the extended family without yet producing the affluence to protect the elderly from poverty and neglect. In India, I have noticed that the existence of such places is often unacknowledged, but on a recent visit to New Delhi, I readily found examples. Their appearance seemed straight out of Dickens, or those old state reports. The Guru Vishram Vrid Ashram, for instance, is a charity-run old-age home in a slum on the south edge of New Delhi, where open sewage ran in the streets and emaciated dogs rummaged in piles of trash. The home is a converted warehouse, a vast open room with scores of disabled elderly people on cots and floor mattresses pushed up against one another like a large sheet of postage stamps. The proprietor, G.P. Bhagat, who appeared to be in his 40s, was clean-cut and professional-looking, with a cell phone that rang every 2 minutes. He said he'd been called by God to open the place 8 years before and subsisted on donations. He said he never turned anyone away as long as he had an open bed. About half of the residents were deposited there by retirement homes and hospitals if they couldn't pay their bills. The other half were found in the streets and parks by volunteers or the police. All suffered from a combination of debility and poverty. The place had more than 100 people when I visited. The youngest was 60 and the oldest past a century. Those on the first floor had only moderate needs. Among them, I met a Sikh man crawling awkwardly along the ground in a squat like a slow-moving frog, hands, feet, hands, feet, hands, feet. He said he used to own an electrical shop in an upscale section of New Delhi. His daughter became an accountant, his son a software engineer. 2 years ago, something happened to him. He described chest pain and what sounded like a series of strokes. He spent 2.5 months in the hospital, paralyzed. The bills rose. His family stopped visiting. Eventually, the hospital dropped him off here. Bhagat said he sent a message to the family through the police saying the man would like to come home. They denied knowing him. Up a narrow staircase was the second floor ward for patients with dementia and other severe disabilities. An old man stood by a wall wailing out-of-tune songs at the top of his lungs. Next to him, a woman with white, cataractal eyes muttered to herself. Several staff members worked their way through the residents, feeding them and keeping them clean the best they could. The din and the smell of urine were overpowering. I tried to talk to a couple of the residents through my translator, but they were too confused to answer questions. A deaf and blind woman lying on a mattress nearby was shouting a few words over and over again. I asked the translator what she was saying. The translator shook her head. The words made no sense, and then she bolted down the stairs. It was too much for her. It was as close to a vision of hell as I've ever experienced. These people are on the last stage of their journey, Bhagat said, looking out upon the mass of bodies. But I can't provide the kind of facility they really require. In the course of Alice's lifetime, the industrialized world's elderly have escaped the threat of such a fate. Prosperity has enabled even the poor to expect nursing homes with square meals, professional health services, physical therapy, and bingo. They've eased debility and old age for millions and made proper care and safety a norm to an extent that the inmates of poorhouses could not imagine. Yet still, most consider modern old age homes frightening, desolate, even odious places to spend the last phase of one's life. We need and desire something more. Longwood House seemingly had everything going for it. The facility was up to date, with top ratings for safety and care. Alice's quarters enabled her to have the comforts of her old home in a safer, more manageable situation. The arrangements were tremendously reassuring for her children and extended family, but they weren't for Alice. She never got used to being there or accepted it. No matter what the staff or family did for her, she grew only more miserable. I asked her about this, but she couldn't put her finger on what made her unhappy. The most common complaint she made is one I've heard often from nursing home residents I've met. It just isn't home. To Alice, Longwood House was a mere facsimile of home. And having a place that genuinely feels like your home can seem as essential to a person as water to a fish. A few years ago, I read about the case of Harry Truman, an 83-year-old man who, in March 1980, refused to budge from his home at the foot of Mount St. Helens near Olympia, Washington, when the volcano began to steam and rumble. A former World War I pilot and Prohibition-era bootlegger, he'd owned his lodge on Spirit Lake for more than half a century. 5 years earlier, he'd been widowed. So now it was just him and his 16 cats on his 54 acres of property beneath the mountain. 3 years earlier, he'd fallen off the lodge roof shoveling snow and broken his leg. The doctor told him he was a damn fool to be working up there at his age. Damn it, Truman shot back. I'm 80 years old, and at 80, I have the right to make up my mind and do what I want to do. As eruption threatened, the authorities told everyone living in the vicinity to clear out, but Truman wasn't going anywhere. For more than 2 months, the volcano smoldered. Authorities extended the evacuation zone to 10 miles around the mountain. Truman stubbornly remained. He didn't believe the scientists, with their uncertain and sometimes conflicting reports. He worried his lodge would be looted and vandalized, as another lodge on Spirit Lake was. And regardless, this home was his life. If this place is going to go, I want to go with it, he said, because if I lost it, it would kill me in a week anyway. He attracted reporters with his straight-talking, curmudgeonly way, holding forth with a green John Deere cap on his head and a tall glass of bourbon and Coke in his hand. The local police thought about arresting him for his own good, but decided not to, given his age and the bad publicity they'd have to endure. They offered to bring him out every chance they got. He steadfastly refused. He told a friend, "If I die tomorrow, I've had a damn good life. I've done everything I could do, and I've done everything I ever wanted to do." The blast came at 8:40 a.m. on May 18, 1980, with the force of an atomic bomb. The entire lake disappeared under the massive lava flow, burying Truman and his cats and his home with it. In the aftermath, he became an icon. The old man who had stayed in his house, taken his chances, and lived life on his own terms in an era when that possibility seemed to have all but disappeared. The people of nearby Castle Rock constructed a memorial to him at the town's entrance that still stands, and there was a television movie starring Art Carney. Alice wasn't facing a volcano, but she might as well have been. Giving up her home on Greencastle Street meant giving up the life she had built for herself over decades. The things that made Longwood House so much safer and more manageable than the house were precisely what made it hard for her to endure. Her apartment might have been called independent living, but it involved the imposition of more structure and supervision than she'd ever had to deal with before. Aides watched her diet. Nurses monitored her health. They observed her growing unsteadiness and made her use a walker. This was reassuring for Alice's children, but she didn't like being nannied or controlled. And the regulation of her life only increased with time. When the staff became concerned that she was missing doses of her medications, they informed her that unless she kept her medications with the nurses and came down to their station twice a day to take them under direct supervision, she would have to move out of independent living to the nursing home wing. Jim and Nan hired a part-time aide named Mary to help Alice comply, to give her some company, and to stave off the day she would have to transfer. She liked Mary, but having her hanging around the apartment for hours on end, often with little to do, only made the situation more depressing. For Alice, it must have felt as if she had crossed into an alien land that she would never be allowed to leave. The border guards were friendly and cheerful enough. They promised her a nice place to live where she'd be well taken care of. But she didn't really want anyone to take care of her. She just wanted to live a life of her own. And those cheerful border guards had taken her keys and her passport. With her home went her control. People saw Harry Truman as a hero. There was never going to be a Longwood House for Harry Truman of Spirit Lake, and Alice Hobson of Arlington, Virginia, didn't want there to be one for her either. How did we wind up in a world where the only choices for the very old seem to be either going down with a volcano or yielding all control over our lives? To understand what happened, you have to trace the story of how we replaced the poorhouse with the kinds of places we have today, and it turns out to be a medical story. Our old age homes didn't develop out of a desire to give the frail elderly better lives than they'd had in those dismal places. We didn't look around and say to ourselves, you know, there's this phase of people's lives in which they can't really cope on their own, and we ought to find a way to make it manageable. No, instead we said, this looks like a medical problem. Let's put these people in the hospital. Maybe the doctors can figure something out. The modern nursing home developed from there, more or less by accident. In the middle part of the 20th century, medicine was undergoing a rapid and historic transformation. Before that time, if you fell seriously ill, doctors usually tended to you in your own bed. The function of hospitals was mainly custodial. As the great physician writer Lewis Thomas observed, describing his internship at Boston City Hospital in 1937, if being in a hospital bed made a difference, it was mostly the difference produced by warmth, shelter, and food, and attentive, friendly care, and the matchless skill of the nurses in providing these things. Whether you survived or not depended on the natural history of the disease itself. Medicine made little or no difference. From World War II onward, the picture shifted radically. Sulfa, penicillin, and then numerous other antibiotics became available for treating infections. Drugs to control blood pressure and treat hormonal imbalances were discovered. Breakthroughs in everything from heart surgery to artificial respirators to kidney transplantation became commonplace. Doctors became heroes, and the hospital transformed from a symbol of sickness and despondency to a place of hope and cure. Communities could not build hospitals fast enough. In America in 1946, Congress passed the Hill-Burton Act, which provided massive amounts of government funds for hospital construction. 2 decades later, the program had financed more than 9,000 new medical facilities across the country. For the first time, most people had a hospital nearby, and this became true across the industrialized world. The magnitude of this transformation is impossible to overstate. For most of our species' existence, people were fundamentally on their own with the sufferings of their body. They depended on nature and chance and the ministry of family and religion. Medicine was just another tool you could try, no different from a healing ritual or a family remedy, and no more effective. But as medicine became more powerful, the modern hospital brought a different idea. Here was a place where you could go saying, "Cure me." You checked in and gave over every part of your life to doctors and nurses, what you wore, what you ate, what went into the different parts of your body, and when. It wasn't always pleasant, but for a rapidly expanding range of problems, it produced unprecedented results. Hospitals learned how to eliminate infections, remove cancerous tumors, reconstruct shattered bones. They could fix hernias and heart valves and hemorrhaging stomach ulcers. They became the normal place for people to go with their bodily troubles, including the elderly. Meanwhile, policy planners had assumed that establishing a pension system would end poorhouses, but the problem did not go away. In America, in the years following the passage of the Social Security Act of 1935, the number of elderly in poorhouses refused to drop. States moved to close them, but found they could not. The reason old people wound up in poorhouses, it turned out, was not just that they didn't have the money to pay for a home. They were there because they'd become too frail, sick, feeble, senile, or broken down to take care of themselves anymore, and they had nowhere else to turn for help. Pensions provided a way of allowing the elderly to manage independently as long as possible in their retirement years, but pensions hadn't provided a plan for that final, infirm stage of mortal life. As hospitals sprang up, they became a comparatively more attractive place to put the infirm. That was finally what brought the poorhouses to empty out. One by one through the 1950s, the poorhouses closed. Responsibility for those who'd been classified as elderly paupers was transferred to departments of welfare, and the sick and disabled were put in hospitals. But hospitals couldn't solve the debilities of chronic illness and advancing age, and they began to fill up with people who had nowhere to go. the hospitals lobbied the government for help, and in 1954, lawmakers provided funding to enable them to build separate custodial units for patients needing an extended period of recovery. That was the beginning of the modern nursing home. They were never created to help people facing dependency in old age. They were created to clear out hospital beds, which is why they were called nursing homes. This has been the persistent pattern of how modern society has dealt with old age. The systems we've devised were almost always designed to solve some other problem. As one scholar put it, describing the history of nursing homes from the perspective of the elderly is like describing the opening of the American West from the perspective of the mules. They were certainly there, and the epical events were certainly critical to the mules, but hardly anyone was paying very much attention to them at the time. The next major spur to American nursing home growth was similarly unintentional. When Medicare, America's health insurance system for the aged and disabled, passed in 1965, the law specified that it would pay only for care in facilities that met basic health and safety standards. A significant number of hospitals, especially in the South, couldn't meet those standards. Policymakers feared a major backlash from elderly patients with Medicare cards being turned away from their local hospital. So the Bureau of Health Insurance invented the concept of substantial compliance. If the hospital came close to meeting the standards and aimed to improve, it would be approved. The category was a complete fabrication with no legal basis, though it solved a problem without major harm. Virtually all of the hospitals did improve. But the Bureau's ruling gave an opening to nursing homes, few of which met even minimum federal standards, such as having a nurse on site or fire protections in place. Thousands of them, asserting that they were in substantial compliance, were approved, and the number of nursing homes exploded. By 1970, some 13,000 of them had been built, and so did reports of neglect and mistreatment. That year, in Marietta, Ohio, the next county over from my hometown, a nursing home fire trapped and killed 32 residents. In Baltimore, a salmonella epidemic in a nursing home claimed 36 lives. With time, regulations were tightened. The health and safety problems were finally addressed. Nursing homes are no longer fire traps, but the core problem persists. This place, where half of us will typically spend a year or more of our lives, was never truly made for us. One morning, Alice had a fall while alone in her apartment. She wasn't found until many hours later when Nan, who was puzzled at not being able to reach her by phone, sent Jim to investigate. He discovered Alice laid out beside the living room couch, nearly unconscious. At the hospital, the medical team gave her intravenous fluids and a series of tests and x-rays. They found no broken bones or head injury. Everything seemed okay. But they also found no explanation for her fall beyond general frailty. When she returned to Longwood House, she was encouraged to move to the skilled nursing floor. She resisted vehemently. She did not want to go. The staff relented. They checked her more frequently. Mary increased the hours she spent looking after her, but before long, Jim got a call that Alice had fallen again. It was a bad fall, they said. She'd been taken by ambulance to a hospital. By the time he got there, she had already been wheeled into surgery. X-rays showed she'd broken her hip. The top of her femur had snapped like a glass stem. The orthopedic surgeons repaired the fracture with a couple of long metal nails. This time, she came back to Longwood House in a wheelchair and needed help with virtually all of her everyday activities, using the toilet, bathing, dressing. Alice was left with no choice but to move into the skilled nursing unit. The hope, they told her, was that with physical therapy, she'd learn to walk again and return to her apartment. But she never did. From then on, she was confined to a wheelchair and the rigidity of nursing home life. All privacy and control were gone. She was put in hospital clothes most of the time. She woke when they told her, bathed and dressed when they told her, ate when they told her. She lived with whomever they said she had to. There was a succession of roommates, never chosen with her input, and all with cognitive impairments. Some were quiet. One kept her up at night. She felt incarcerated, like she was in prison for being old. The sociologist Irving Goffman noted the likeness between prisons and nursing homes half a century ago in his book, Asylums. They were, along with military training camps, orphanages, and mental hospitals, total institutions, places largely cut off from wider society. A basic social arrangement in modern society is that the individual tends to sleep, play, and work in different places, with different co-participants, under different authorities, and without an overall rational plan, he wrote. By contrast, total institutions break down the barriers separating our spheres of life in specific ways that he enumerated. First, all aspects of life are conducted in the same place and under the same central authority. Second, each phase of the member's daily activity is carried on in the immediate company of a large batch of others, all of whom are treated alike and required to do the same thing together. Third, all phases of the day's activities are tightly scheduled, with one activity leading at a prearranged time into the next, the whole sequence of activities being imposed from above by a system of explicit formal rulings and a body of officials. Finally, the various enforced activities are brought together into a single plan purportedly designed to fulfill the official aims of the institution. In a nursing home, the official aim of the institution is caring, but the idea of caring that had evolved didn't bear any meaningful resemblance to what Alice would call living. She was hardly alone in feeling this way. I once met an 89-year-old woman who had, of her own volition, checked herself into a Boston nursing home. Usually, it's the children who push for a change, but in this case, she was the one who did. She had congestive heart failure, disabling arthritis, and after a series of falls, she felt she had little choice but to leave her condominium in Delray Beach, Florida. "I fell twice in 1 week, and I told my daughter I don't belong at home anymore," she said. She picked the facility herself. It had excellent ratings and nice staff, and her daughter lived nearby. She had moved in the month before I met her. She told me she was glad to be in a safe place. If there's anything a decent nursing home is built for, it is safety. But she was wretchedly unhappy. The trouble was that she expected more from life than safety. "I know I can't do what I used to," she said, "but this feels like a hospital, not a home." It is a near universal reality. Nursing home priorities are matters like avoiding bed sores and maintaining residents' weight, important medical goals to be sure, but they are means, not ends. The woman had left an airy apartment she furnished herself for a small beige hospital-like room with a stranger for a roommate. Her belongings were stripped down to what she could fit into the one cupboard and shelf they gave her. Basic matters like when she went to bed, woke up, dressed, and ate were subject to the rigid schedule of institutional life. She couldn't have her own furniture or a cocktail before dinner because it wasn't safe. There was so much more she felt she could do in her life. "I want to be helpful, play a role," she said. She used to make her own jewelry, volunteer at the library. Now her main activities were bingo, DVD movies, and other forms of passive group entertainment. The things she missed most, she told me, were her friendships, privacy, and a purpose to her days. Nursing homes have come a long way from the fire trap warehouses of neglect they used to be, but it seems we've succumbed to a belief that once you lose your physical independence, a life of worth and freedom is simply not possible. The elderly themselves have not completely succumbed, however. Many resist. In every nursing home and assisted living facility, battles rage over the priorities and values people are supposed to live by. Some, like Alice, resist mainly through non-cooperation, refusing the scheduled activities or medications. They are the ones we call feisty. It's a favorite word for the aged. Outside a nursing home, we usually apply the adjective with a degree of admiration. We like the tenacious, sometimes cantankerous ways in which the Harry Trumans of the world assert themselves. But inside, when we say someone is feisty, we mean it in a less complimentary way. Nursing home staff like and approve of residents who are fighters and show dignity and self-esteem, until these traits interfere with the staff's priorities for them. Then they are feisty. Talk to the staff members and you will hear about the daily skirmishes. A woman calls for help to the bathroom every 5 minutes, so they put her on a set schedule, taking her to the bathroom once every couple hours when it fits into their rounds. But she doesn't go according to schedule, instead wetting her bed 10 minutes after a bathroom trip. So now they put her in a diaper. Another resident refuses to use his walker and takes unauthorized, unaccompanied walks. A third sneaks cigarettes and alcohol. Food is the Hundred Years' War. A woman with severe Parkinson's disease keeps violating her pureed diet restriction, stealing food from other residents that could cause her to choke. A man with Alzheimer's disease hoards snacks in his room, violating house rules. A diabetic is found eating clandestine sugar cookies and pudding, knocking his blood sugar levels off his target. Who knew you could rebel just by eating a cookie? In the horrible places, the battle for control escalates until you get tied down, or locked into your Jerry chair, or chemically subdued with psychotropic medications. In the nice ones, a staff member cracks a joke, wags an affectionate finger, and takes your brownie stash away. In almost none, does anyone sit down with you and try to figure out what living a life really means to you under the circumstances, let alone help you make a home where that life becomes possible. This is the consequence of a society that faces the final phase of the human life cycle by trying not to think about it. We end up with institutions that address any number of societal goals, from freeing up hospital beds to taking burdens off families' hands to coping with poverty among the elderly, but never the goal that matters to the people who reside in them. How to make life worth living when we're weak and frail and can't fend for ourselves anymore. One day when Jim visited Alice, she whispered something in his ear. It was winter, 1994. A few weeks after her hip fracture and admission to the skilled nursing unit, and 2 years since she'd begun living at Longwood House. He'd wheeled her from her room for a stroll around the complex. They found a comfortable place in the lobby and stopped to sit for a while. They were both quiet people, and they'd been content to sit there silently, watching people come and go. That was when she leaned toward him in her wheelchair. She whispered just 2 words. "I'm ready," she said. He looked at her. She looked at him. And he understood. She was ready to die. "Okay, Mom," Jim said. It saddened him. He wasn't sure what to do about it, but not long afterward, the two of them arranged for a do-not-resuscitate order to be put on record at the nursing home. If her heart or her breathing stopped, they would not attempt to rescue her from death. They would not do chest compressions or shock her or put a breathing tube down her throat. They would let her go. Months passed. She waited and endured. One April night, she developed abdominal pains. She mentioned them briefly to a nurse, then decided to say nothing more. Later, she vomited blood. She alerted no one. She didn't press the call button or say anything to her roommate. She stayed in bed, silent. The next morning, when the aides came to wake the residents on her floor, they found she was gone.